The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the June 19, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Civil Disturbance, by Saeed Sayrafizadeh. We're sitting underneath the overpass, Molly and I, lights off, motor on, staring through the windshield at the row of houses up the hill. On Molly's lap, propped against the steering wheel, is the clipboard with the street addresses, about 50 of them, listed alongside the pertinent info, name, age, etc., culled from the internet and written in her perfect handwriting, evidence that she had gone to a good school in the suburbs. It's getting dark, and it's getting cold, and neither one of us has said more than a few passive-aggressive sentences to the other, like when I thanked her for putting her window up, as if she'd done me a big favor. "You're welcome," she said, but she only closed it halfway. The bickering had started after we both got home from work. First we were arguing, then we were shouting, and then she disappeared into the bedroom and slammed the door hard, emerging 15 minutes later, composed, dressed, and ready to go. Today's particular conflict had been set in motion by the banal "who'd left a cereal bowl in the sink," but obviously indicated a wider problem. Plus, it was compounded by the latest poll numbers, which put our candidate 3 points behind, with 3 days to go until the election. "The personal is political," Molly always says, implying that if we break up, it won't be her fault. Meanwhile, the future of the city hangs in the balance, things going from bad to worse, public transportation, mail delivery, garbage removal. Thanks to the mayor, 6 terms and still nothing to show for it. "Look at the data," she tells me, but I never know what data she's talking about. She's the one with the poli-sci degree in this relationship, socially engaged and crunching numbers. And I'm the former high school jock, lettering in 3 sports at the expense of my GPA. Sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night and see her next to me, looking at her laptop, pie charts glowing up in her face. In the beginning, when times were good, this would have been something of an aphrodisiac, her passion and intelligence radiating beneath the covers. Now she's all business. Now there's no time to lose. She says, "The mayor is ipso jure unlawful." She uses Latin. And she uses words like populous. She talks as if she were composing a term paper with footnotes. Later, I'll look things up and still not understand. "The only question that remains," she says, "is whether the populace has the strength to take matters into its own hands." "I doubt it," I tell her. "Have faith," she says. It's getting darker, and it's getting colder. Leaves are swirling beneath the overpass, with no trees in sight. According to the data, this is the ideal time to canvass, early evening, inclement weather. I want Molly to close her window all the way, but that would mean asking for the same favor twice. Our silence has deepened into something existential. It's not only the silence in the car, it's the silence drifting toward us from the unknown neighborhood, winding streets with unknown homes with unknown residents. In a sudden burst of awkward motion, I lunge across the center console, knocking the clipboard off Molly's lap and accidentally running my elbow against her thighs. I press the button and the window glides up. She snorts with satisfaction. "Dress better next time," she says. "There won't be a next time," I say. She likes this, too. The warm air from the vent is blowing around my head, trapped in the car, steaming up the windshield, obscuring the gloom outside. I put my seat back a notch, and then I put it back several more notches, and when I closed my eyes, I could be lying on a beach chair by the shore of the man-made lake, floating somewhere between awake and asleep. In my semi-conscious limbo, I can feel the ghostly imprint of Molly's thighs against my elbow, reminding me of when times were good. I've been up since 6 o'clock this morning, eating my bowl of cereal before work at the high-end fitness center that's in the strip mall between Walmart and a vacant lot. It's a decent job, all things considered. Weekends off, holidays off, also dental. The last one, thanks to the mayor, or blood money for the populace, depending on where you stand. All day long, prospective clients stop by my office, inquiring about signing up for a membership. First month complimentary. Well, you've come to the right place, I told them, turning on the charm. A sales rep in athleisure. They took a seat across from my desk, surrounded by framed photos of me from my glory days in high school, while I asked them personal questions about their bodies. Height, weight, BMI. There I am in my football uniform. There I am on the pitcher's mound. There I am holding the municipal trophy after the championship win. It was my manager who suggested that the photos would be good for sales. Subliminal advertising, he told me. He also was a standout high school athlete, as was his manager before him. None of us had realized that by the time we were 18, we'd already reached the pinnacle of our careers. And suddenly I hear a hard knocking on my passenger side window, a knocking so hard that I think the glass is going to break, and my eyes are open, heart racing, confirming what I already know, that we shouldn't be sitting underneath the overpass with the lights off and the motor on. Through the foggy window, I can see the blurred outline of a man in uniform, enormous from my perspective, 7 feet tall and out of a fairy tale, probably a police officer or maybe paramilitary. He wants me to open my window right now, and the cold air blows in my face, along with a flashlight beam blinding me. Is there a problem, officer? I ask from my prone position. I'll tell you what to do and when to do it, he says. He doesn't want me to unlock my door. He doesn't want me to show him my license. He doesn't want me to sit up straight. What are you doing here, he asks me. I'm canvassing, I say. Well, what does that mean, he says. It means I'm here for the election. Well, the election is 3 days away. I know, I say, I'm canvassing. Well, what does that mean? I can't get past square one, which is where he wants me. He thinks he's caught me in a big lie. He wants to know what's in the Walmart bag in the back seat. Bricks from a vacant lot, I tell him. And why do you have bricks from a vacant lot, he asks. Because he probably assumes that I'm planning on breaking windows. Political intimidation before the election. Cleaning up the city, I say. He's not sure if he should believe me. His gun is on his hip, his hand by the holster. In a moment, he's going to open the car door and tell me to run, give me a head start, and then shoot me in the back before I can make it out from under the overpass. First, though, he's shining his flashlight inside the car. Clipboard, dashboard, center console, Molly's face. I can hear Molly shouting, trapped and terrified in the driver's seat, and then she's out of the car without being given permission, running toward the officer, and he's meeting her halfway, throwing his arms around her, lifting her off her feet, saying he can't believe how tall she's got, and Molly's blushing memories from the suburbs returning full force. He's asked her how her mom and dad are, how her brother is. She's catching him up with broad strokes. Since we're underneath the overpass, everything has a slight echo to it. Mum-mum-mum-mum, dad-da-da-dad. He's seeing the little girl all grown up. He's seeing the passage of time made flesh. He doesn't care about me anymore. He doesn't care what canvassing means or what's in the Walmart bag. When they're done reminiscing and hugging, he shakes my hand. No hard feelings. Nice to meet you, he says, his big glove swallowing my bare palm. Then Molly gets back in, cheeks flushed, smiling and waving goodbye, and we watch through the windshield as he walks off, fading into the darkness. She puts the car in drive. She lets the brake off slowly. Don't worry, she tells me. He'll be the first to hang. Never mind what the pie charts say. Canvassing in the cold at night is not optimal. This is dinner time. This is couch time. This is prime time. We're in one of those so-called modest neighborhoods, not yet all the way poor, thanks to the mayor. You can tell by the satellite dishes on the roofs. You can tell by the curbside parking. I grew up in a neighborhood not unlike this one. You can tell by my handwriting. Displayed on the rusting porches are campaign signs for the incumbent, orange and yellow. No text needed. Everyone knows what the colors signify. We're entering hostile territory, so to speak. Their candidate is not our candidate. At the first four houses, no one bothers to answer when I ring the doorbell, even though we can hear the TV. I know they're home, Molly says, and before we leave, she makes a notation on her clipboard. What are you notating, I ask.
Data, she says.
By the time we reach the eighth house, I'm shivering in my athleisure, and my thumb feels numb when I ring the doorbell, twice, and then two more times. We can hear it tolling through the house, and just as I'm about to suggest that we get back in the car, the door cracks open, chain still on, two faces staring at us, husband and wife. What's this in regard to? The wife asks right away. She sounds aggrieved. She looks concerned. As far as she knows, we've come to strong-arm them into supporting our candidate, or else. We're living in the age of suspicion, after all, and I don't blame her. It was done in the previous election and the one before that. Neighborhoods of burned hedges and broken doors and stolen satellite dishes. And both times it managed to reduce voter turnout, if only slightly. We'd like a moment of your time, Molly says, big, welcoming smile, trying to sound casual as she reads lines from the script in her head. No, I'm wrong. The wife is not intimidated by us, and neither is her husband. Oh, we don't have time for this, he tells us.
Do you have time to make our city a better place? Molly asks.
Oh, what's wrong with our city? He wants to know. He's glaring at me as if I'd said something to offend him. I'm still holding out hope that he will take off the chain and invite us inside, where we can chat politics more comfortably. But Molly has her agenda ready to go. Potholes in the streets, backed up sewage lines, intermittent cell service, you name it. And that's just for starters.
Give them the brochure, sweetheart, she tells me.
Through the crack in the door, I slip them the campaign brochure with a picture of our candidate walking through a vacant lot that's remained undeveloped for six terms. One of the many vacant lots that the citizens have had to endure. His sleeves rolled up, his face airbrushed above the catch-all catchphrase, "Take back our city." The wife unfolds the brochure half-heartedly. There's our candidate's 10-point plan all laid out, his professional accomplishments, his family history in the metropolitan area, beginning five generations ago, before the dam was built and the lake was made. What's he going to do about the electricity? The husband wants to know. He's going to fix the electricity. Of course he is. He's going to get the garbage collected. Yes to everything, Molly says. No to nothing. How about the surcharge? The wife asks. This catches Molly off guard. She's sputtering, blinking hard. She hasn't thought about the surcharge because she grew up in the suburbs. No to the surcharge, she offers, but this is the wrong answer. Yes to the surcharge, but now it's too late to backtrack. They've heard enough. They've made up their minds. We're also letting cold air into the house. The husband returns the brochure to me, pinching it with his fingertips. Well, that's yours to keep, I tell him, my breath coming out in short white puffs. No, thank you, he says. Back in the car, I'm rubbing my hands in front of the vents while Molly jots down her notations on the clipboard. Ipso churi the surcharge, I say, I snicker. In one swift motion, Molly slams the clipboard on the steering wheel, making the car horn beep. Well, I'd like to see you do better, she says. She's shouting for the second time today. Shh, I say. The neighbors are going to hear you. Well, let them hear me, she says. And right then, a family of four comes walking by carrying Walmart bags. But they don't notice us. They don't care. They've heard it all before. Molly's pointing her red pen in my cold face. Her gaze has narrowed to murderous accusation.
worse than the beam from the officer's flashlight. I suppose we should have realized long ago that we weren't right for each other. Realize, even on that first date of ours, eating dinner at Applebee's, my choice, the one next to Starbucks in a vacant lot, where we sat across from each other in the big booth, feeling far apart, not unlike how it feels now. We were already on the mayor's third term, but she didn't mind how little I knew about local politics. I could name the governor and the important dates, like the year the city had been incorporated, the basics everyone learned in grade school, suburban or otherwise. But beyond the basics, I was somewhere between apathetic and clueless. When Molly spoke, she used phrases like et alia and post hoc. When I spoke, I talked about high school baseball. Meanwhile, we sipped our red wine, and as we did, we got more compatible. Until the Applebee's booth seemed to shrink in size, and from beneath the table, I could feel her knee pressing against mine. The personal is political, she said to me. We drive through the neighborhood in silence again, the only sound coming from the car bouncing up and down in the potholes. We get lucky at the next four houses, insofar as the door is opened right away, but after that, it's the same routine. Points talked, brochure returned. 20 minutes later, it's beginning to snow, and the wind blows off the lake into my face. This time, when the door opens, it's a young couple about our age, ready for bed in their pajamas, and I cut right to the chase before Molly has a chance to say anything. Do you want to take back the city? I asked them. I'm going off script, sales rep that I am, gauging the mood, speaking the customer's language, just like my manager taught me. Yes, they said. Yes, we do. They're eager. They're interested. I hand them the brochure with our candidate's airbrush face, and I tell them confidently, he's older than he looks. They like this, of course, this frank admission of artifice. I'm doing what I do best at the upscale fitness center, undersell, and then go high. The first thing I bring up is the electrical grid, its flickering lights, weekend brownouts, and soon enough they're sharing stories with me about the power outage 5 years ago, the one everyone still talks about, 2 months of hardship with no lights or water. No TV, I said. We're laughing together now, the couple in the pajamas and me, and before I can even explain what our candidate is going to do about the surcharge, they've made up their minds. They're shaking my cold hand. They're keeping the brochure, as they do at the next house, and the one after that. In the instances when I do happen to fail, Molly makes her notations. By the time we arrive at the last address on the list, it's 10 o'clock, and there are 2 inches of snow on the ground, soaking my feet because I'm wearing sneakers. We can hear the doorbell chiming, and Molly tells me to press it again. But we catch the sound of footsteps approaching. Then the door opens slightly, and there's Bryce, of all people, staring at me. Bryce from high school, straight-A student in Mrs. Morrison's class, where I would casually bully him from the back row, star athlete that I was. What's this in regard to? He asked. He's still so skinny that it looks as if he could walk through the door crack without having to take the chain off. Bryce, I say, it's me. But he doesn't recognize me. He's blinking hard behind his glasses. How do you know my name? He asked me. It's on the clipboard, Molly says. It's from high school, I say. The snow is swirling in front of my face, but suddenly I seem to come into focus for him, and he's taking the chain off, letting it dangle to the side, swinging the door wide open, and now it's my turn to have a blast from the past. Bryce hugging me so hard that it feels like his thin arms might snap. Apparently, he has fond memories from Mrs. Morrison class, never mind that I would poke him in the neck with a pencil, but it was all in good fun, right? No hard feelings now. Now he's letting me into his house where I can feel the heat enveloping me, thanks to the mayor. His living room is sparsely furnished. One couch, one chair, no TV. And the lone lamp casts dim light over the bare walls. If Bryce has managed to do anything with those straight A's, I can't tell by his home. When I sit down on the couch, it sags beneath me. When Molly sits down, it feels as if we might sink through the cushions. The snow is beginning to melt off my shoes, leaving puddles on the area rug, and this makes me feel bad, but Bryce doesn't seem to notice. He wants to reminisce about the good times, which are mostly my good times, my face all over the yearbook, playing in the championship game at the City Coliseum in front of 3,000 fans, including the mayor, way back when it was only his second term, when the promise was still fresh. What game was this? Molly wants to know. The baseball game, Bryce says. I never liked baseball, Molly says. Speaking of the mayor, I tell him how he came into the locker room after the championship to congratulate us, wearing one of our team hats, with the logo of the sun setting over the man-made lake. Propaganda, Molly says. The mayor shook everyone's hand, one by one, teammates, coaches, school principal, and when he reached me at the end of the line, I could barely lift my arm because I'd pitched six innings. He leaned in, bill of his cap touching mine, and whispered, as if I were the only person he had ever said this to, "The city needs men like you, son." Bryce shakes his head. "I never liked the mayor," he says, which is what Molly's been waiting to hear, of course. She manages with great difficulty to move herself to the edge of the couch, looking Bryce in his glasses, ally to ally, talking about the electrical grid and the garbage collection. And Bryce is with her every step of the way, plumbing, public transportation. "Yes, yes, yes," they're saying, full agreement. Bryce is telling about how he once dreamed of moving somewhere else, maybe to the city on the other side of the lake. Instead, he works at Walmart, which is what straight A's in high school will get you. It just so happens that this is the same Walmart that's next to my fitness center in the strip mall. One more surprise for the evening. "Stop by and see me sometime," I tell him. "I can get you half price on the first 3 months." It's the least I can do for all the times that he let me cheat off his tests. Blood money for the bully, I suppose. "I don't like to exercise," he says and shrugs. "Well, maybe I will," he adds, but he probably won't. Molly's done with small talk and sports talk. She's trying to get us back on track. "Do you have time to make our city a better place?" she asks Bryce. Which is my cue to hand him the campaign brochure. But before I can, Bryce is handing me a campaign brochure. Where it came from, I don't know. And it's for the third party candidate, the one who has no chance of winning and who's only going to complicate everything for everyone. "Municipality first," the brochure reads in big blue letters, whatever that means. Now it's Bryce's turn to tell us about how his candidate is going to do this and that, how he has a plan for the surcharge and the plumbing and everything that ails this city. His plans are not our plans. Molly is trying to explain what our plans are, but Bryce already knows about our plans. He seems to know more about our plans than we know about our plans. "He has a plan for everything," Bryce says.
"Well, we'll just have to agree to disagree," Molly says.
She's already rising off the sagging couch, handing the brochure back to Bryce, all 12 points included, two more than ours. "Oh, that's yours to keep," Bryce says.
"No, thank you," Molly says.
Back on the front porch, with the snow coming down hard and the wind gusting off the lake, Molly makes her notations on the clipboard.
"He can't be won over," she says.
It snows all night and the next day, too. And then we get even more bad news. Our candidate has gained only a point in the polls, maybe less, depending on which numbers are being crunched, while the third-party candidate has held steady. We haven't said much to each other, Molly and I. We haven't shouted or screamed, even though one of us left a bowl in the sink again. Neither of us had the heart to escalate, and no doors have been slammed. Perhaps we've moved beyond arguing. Perhaps we're on the downslope, heading toward the exit, with one day left before the election. To make matters worse, the municipal plows have come through and cleared the streets of 8 inches of snow. Ordinarily, this would be a positive thing. But according to Molly, it's a strategy by the mayor to make him look good and to make sure that everyone will be able to get to the polls. No voter suppression this time around. You shovel the streets when you're winning, Molly says. As for me, I have no problem driving to work through the morning city with the heat on high and the windows all the way up and the vacant lots empty. 30 minutes later, I arrive at the fitness center to find Bryce standing in my office, waiting for me, dressed in his Walmart outfit, a blue vest with Proud Walmart Associate emblazoned on it. He looks even skinnier in his uniform. I've had a change of heart, he says. He's not talking about the election. He's talking about exercising. He shakes my hand as if we'd already completed the deal, and it feels as though his fingers would break if I squeezed just a little bit harder. You've come to the right place, I say, using my casual opening line. I tell him to take a seat, offer him vitamin water. I'm ready to lay it on thick. But it turns out that he doesn't have time for this. I'm on my lunch break, he says. He eats lunch at 9 o'clock in the morning. So I cut the introductory sales pitch and take him straight upstairs, showing him the kettlebells, the barbells, and the floor-to-ceiling mirrors. There are some people working out, sexy and sweating. You can't buy that kind of advertising. We have everything, I say. I gave a wide sweep of my arm, including the people working out. I'm starting with the soft sell for a level A membership. Then I take him past the sauna on purpose. When he walks in front of me, I can see the Walmart logo plastered on his back, somewhere between an asterisk and a bullseye. Is the sauna included? He wants to know. Well, that's level B, I tell him. I'm waiting for him to slowly climb up the ladder of price points until he reaches the uppermost rung with laundry service and spa treatments. Is the shaving cream included? He asks me. Downstairs in my office, I pull up the forms on my computer, quickly dispensing with the standard checklist. What are your goals? I ask him. I suppose he could ask me the same thing. He wants strength. He wants stamina. Well, what about definition? I say. He wants to know how much things are going to cost. Oh, we can figure that out later, I tell him, as though we're in this together, but I already know the price. I can see that he's on the fence, the story of his life, with his lunch break almost over. Above our heads is the sound of the aerobics class getting underway, the thumping of 20 pairs of feet in unison. This is when I start doing the hard sell, because I get paid on commission, talking to him about testosterone, about how studies have shown that exercise boosts testosterone, about how testosterone allows you to achieve your goals. Look at the data, I say. He's nodding along as if what I'm saying makes sense, but frankly, I don't think he'll take advantage of any of this. He'll probably come every day for the first week of his membership, full of new beginnings and high expectations, and then get discouraged and come less and less, and then not at all until New Year's Day. In the meantime, his credit card will still be charged monthly. None of that was my problem. He's sitting across from me, his eyes darting around behind his glasses, and we could be back in Mrs. Morrison's class, me with my sneakers and my muscles, and Bryce with his sloping shoulders and concave chest. And suddenly, I feel sad about everything. The politics, the mayor, the photos that surround me from my glory days. What I really want to tell Bryce is that he should save his money. That when his shift is over today, he can go to the vacant lot and do 10 pull-ups on a steel beam. If he can't do 10, do one. And when he gets home, he can do jumping jacks on his area rug with the soggy footprints that I left there. In other words, he can take matters into his own hands. And that's when the power in the building goes out and the sounds of the aerobics class stop, and even if Bryce did want to sign up, I wouldn't be able to print out the forms. Thanks to the mayor, Molly would say. Bathed in the red glow of the emergency exit sign, I open my desk drawer and remove a pack of 10 razors, courtesy of the fitness center. Take them, I say, they're yours. Blood money from the bully, I suppose. We're sitting underneath the overpass.
Molly and I, lights off, motor on, staring through the windshield at the row of houses up the hill, just as we did two nights ago. Except now, it's almost midnight. On Molly's lap is the clipboard with the notations written in her perfect handwriting. It's dark and it's cold, and the election is tomorrow. But I'm dressed right this time, coat, hat, and boots, because it just takes me once to learn my lesson. Molly puts the car in drive. We slowly make our way into the so-called modest neighborhood, the silence broken only when she hits a pothole by mistake. "Sorry," she says. The neighborhood is asleep now, but every so often we can see the flickering of a television behind a front window, people putting their satellite dishes to use. At the first house on the list, Molly pulls over. This is the house whose residents couldn't be bothered to answer the door, even though I rang the bell at least twice. From the Walmart bag in the back seat, I take out a brick, and it feels oddly light in my hand, as if it might be hollow. And when I open the car door, I hear Molly telling me to be careful. "I will," I say. And standing there in the sidewalk, impervious to the chill coming off the lake, I hurl the brick and it disappears into the darkness. And for a moment, I think that it's landed in the hedge, but then comes a sudden concussive shattering of glass. Somewhere a dog barks, but other than that, there's no response, which is to be expected. On we go, driving through the neighborhood, stopping at all the houses where no one answered the door. One after another, the sound of glass shattering, and then the house of the husband and wife who answered the door but couldn't be bothered to take our brochure. "No to the surcharge," Molly had said. She was only trying to do her best. As for the houses where people kept the brochure, those we passed by. The reality is that it's not so easy to throw a brick through a window. And soon I sense a dull but troubling pain in my hand and elbow, radiating up my arm and into my neck and down my back. And then the bricks begin to feel heavy, and then very heavy. And then they feel as though they are 5-10 times larger than a brick, as if I'm trying to throw a kettlebell. And it's difficult for me to wrap my hand around them. Occasionally, I completely miss my mark, and the brick lands with a thump on the porch, several feet short. And one time I threw it into a snowbank and have to dig around until I find it. But more often than not, I hit the target, athlete that I was, breaking the window in one try, and sometimes there's a shout of surprise, but usually there's only silence, the residents understanding implicitly the significance of a brick coming through the window on the night before the election. With the dark sky slowly beginning to change to amber, Molly pulls up in front of Bryce's house, the last on the list. There is a little light in the living room, as if Bryce might already be up, getting dressed in his Walmart uniform and shaving with one of his free razors. I feel a burning sensation in my hand and elbow when I throw the final brick. And as the window breaks, I remember how my coach used to counsel me that pain was temporary, son, but that pride lasts forever. And how this helped me get me through the game. Because I believed him. Because I wanted to be a winner above all else. And sure enough, he called me into his office at the end of my senior year, where I waited for him to give me the news of the scouts that had been in the stands watching me pitch in the championship game. "Have you ever considered a career in the fitness industry?" he asked me. When I get back into the car, I'm breathing hard, and Molly and I sit there together for a moment, neither of us saying anything. And after a while, I slip my hand between her thighs, my good hand, and she lets the brake off slowly, and we roll underneath the overpass, back toward home, the sun beginning to rise over the city, where later today, our candidate will win by half a percentage point. And now, from the books section of the June 12, 2023 issue of The New Yorker, "Economists Love Immigration. Why Do So Many Americans Hate It?"
In a democracy, a policy appraisal has to contend with political as well as economic consequences. By Idris Kaloun. On October 5, 1908, a hammy melodrama made its debut in Washington, D.C. Israel Sangwill's The Melting Pot, a four-act play that introduced the dominant metaphor for the American immigrant experience. The plot is thin. A New York tenement romance, threatened by an old-world blood feud, is mended by the salvific power of patriotism. Mostly, it's a pretext for pontificating about a new American religion. America is God's crucible, the great melting pot where all the races of Europe are melting and reforming. The protagonist, a struggling Jewish composer named David Kixano, proclaims, "What is the glory of Rome and Jerusalem, where all nations and races come to worship and look back, compared with the glory of America, where all races and nations come to labor and look forward?" The critics were mainly contemptuous, sentimental trash masquerading as a human document, the New York Times judged. Across the Atlantic, the Times of London declared the plays rhapsodizing over music and crucibles and statues of liberty to be romantic claptrap. But when President Theodore Roosevelt attended the premiere, he was utterly smitten. "That's a great play, Mr. Zangwill, that's a great play," he's said to have shouted. The vivid allegory of souls melting in the crucible and divine fires purging inherited rivalries imprinted something indelible on the American psyche. The play arrived during a heyday of immigration. Ellis Island was at peak capacity, accepting 1,900 newcomers a day. One in seven Americans was foreign-born. Although plenty of native-born Americans were troubled, Zangwill's open-hearted sentiment spoke to many others. Yet only a few years later, the play's hopefulness seemed dated and out of step. The First World War heightened suspicion of foreigners who competed for jobs, maybe harboring Unionist sympathies, and dressed and spoke oddly, maybe never planning to assimilate. In 1924, the Times published a screed complaining that, quote, "The melting pot, besides having its own color, begins to give out its own smell. Its reek fills New York and floats out rather widely in all directions," end quote. That same year, Congress passed the Johnson-Reed Act, which set extremely low quotas on total immigration and barred people from Asia. For the next four decades, the great godly smelting machines would largely sit idle. Alongside that history of xenophobia, of course, is a civic creed that we teach school children and roll out for public ceremonies, the one that declares America to be a nation of immigrants, even if the melting pot metaphor has been replaced with kaleidoscopes, mosaics, and salad bowls, plus a rueful acknowledgement of those whose arrival was a matter of abduction and slavery. We might exult in the economic advantages we owe to immigration, though both ordinary population growth and extraordinary entrepreneurship, then Andrew Carnegie, titan of steel, now Sundar Pichai, titan of search. The fact remains that mass migration and nativist backlash have stalked one another for more than a century. However enthusiastic the America dogma may be about the immigrant's past, rising migration levels invariably trigger the fear that immigrants' present and future may be something different, a drag on the welfare state, a threat to native laborers, a pox on the culture. The politics of immigration have always made for strange bedfellows. Free-trading Ayn Rand acolytes join with cosmopolitan social justice progressives in encouraging more migration. Cultural conservatives join with old guard trade unionists in opposition. Sorting through the thicket of questions, economic, political, and philosophical, posed by immigration has always been difficult. But those questions have gained urgency as the cycle now repeats itself. The percentage of foreign-born Americans is currently at a level last seen a century ago, and it continues to rise. Today, the Know-Nothing Party of the mid-19th century has been reborn in the contemporary GOP.
The America First movement, once championed by the aviator Charles Lindbergh, has a new avatar in Donald Trump. Joe Biden's policies to staunch unauthorized migration across the southern border, meanwhile, suggest Trumpism with a human face. And in New York City, behind Lady Liberty's back, Mayor Eric Adams is busing unwanted migrants to Canada. Our present-day paroxysms can be traced to the reopening of America's borders in the mid-20th century. This time, the arrivals were mainly non-Europeans. The Hart-Celler Act of 1965 allowed migration from Asia once more. Guest worker programs greatly increased the United States' Hispanic population. A diversity lottery program that was started in 1990 helped enable sizable immigration from Africa. At the same time, demand for immigration far outstripped the number of available visas. Familial preferences in immigration applications meant that an individual entrant could effectively relocate an entire clan. This feature, sometimes derided as chain migration, is rather dear to me. My uncle, an adventurous doctor from a small Punjabi village near Sialkot, Pakistan, moved to West Virginia in 1971. As a result, all 11 of his siblings, including, in Gabriel Garcia Marquez style, six brothers who all had the first name Muhammad, were able to wend their way to America. My mother, the 10th of the litter, ended up in Lexington, Kentucky, where I was born in 1994. With a few substitutions of place and date, many Americans can tell some variant of this tale. What has all this global movement actually done to America? The political arguments are harder to answer than the economic ones. Although the dismal science is rife with disagreement on many topics, from microeconomists butting heads about the irrationality of human preferences to macroeconomists arguing about how to quell inflation, there is a broad consensus that immigration is largely beneficial to migrants and their hosts alike. In 2017, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine released a mammoth report titled The Economic and Fiscal Consequences of Immigration. It found that, although immigrants tend to earn less than native-born workers and are therefore a bit more costly to governments, their children exhibit unusually high levels of upward mobility and, quote, are among the strongest economic and fiscal contributors in the population, end quote. For a country with an aging labor force like the U.S., immigration can act like Botox for the welfare state, temporarily making the math of paying for promised benefits like Social Security and Medicare less daunting. Eventually, age comes for the immigrants, too. A breezy but powerful case for the consensus view is made in Streets of Gold, America's Untold Story of Immigrant Success, published by Public Affairs, by Ran Abramitsky and Leah Bustan, the professors of economics at Stanford and Princeton, respectively. Many of their arguments come from their analysis of a fascinating big data set, genealogical records collected by Ancestry.com. When the researchers started gathering the site's data with an internet scraper, its lawyers sent a cease and desist letter. Seeing the long-run benefit of immigration requires measurement, quote, at the pace of generations rather than years, end quote. Abramitsky and Bustan contend. In combination with detailed census records, the ancestral data debunk the idea that earlier waves of European migrants were more industrious and more culturally smeltable than contemporary migrants from elsewhere. Quote, newcomers today are just as quick to move up the economic ladder as in the past, and immigrants now are integrating into American culture just as surely as immigrants back then, end quote. Unlike the other big Anglo countries, such as Australia, Britain, and Canada, America lacks a points-based system that explicitly advantages the already educated and already wealthy. But Abramitsky and Bustan disagree with conservative critics who argue that we should adopt one. Their analysis of a century of immigration data finds, quote, very few countries from which the fact of upward mobility does not hold, end quote. Even if migrants arrive poor, quote, one generation later, their children more than pay for their parents' debts, end quote. Empirical economic research has tended to affirm conclusions suggested by the discipline's first principles. The argument for the free trade of goods, dating back to Adam Smith, implies an argument for the free movement of labor. Michael Clemens, a prominent economist of immigration, maintains that present-day migration barriers are so self-defeating that they are analogous to governments leaving trillion-dollar bills on the sidewalk. The gains from looser migration, in his analysis, would be several times larger than the gains from eliminating all remaining trade barriers. The essential question is not what size the potential windfall would be, but who benefits. The primary beneficiaries are the migrants themselves, who in rich countries can earn a multiple of their old wages. Their homelands can also benefit from the transfers of money. Remittances made up more than one-fifth of the national incomes of countries such as El Salvador, Haiti, and Honduras. But what about their host nations, who may be effectively subsidizing this global redistribution? Ecologists distinguish between interspecies relationships that are parasitic, as between tapeworms and humans, and those which are mutualistic, like the bromance between clownfish and the anemones you may remember from Finding Nemo, in which both parties benefit. In the domestic politics of immigration, restrictionists are convinced that immigrants are parasites. Economists might try harder to correct that picture. Consider winemaking, which for pioneering economists like Adam Smith was a favorite way of illustrating the benefits of trade. In America today, the wine industry provides employment to nearly 2 million people. It also provides revenue to the government by the billions and semblances of personalities to people by the millions. At the same time, domestic winemaking is made possible by temporary guest workers, typically from Mexico, who harvest grapes, including at the winery owned by Donald Trump. Are foreign agricultural laborers hurting job prospects for hardworking Americans? Cesar Chavez, the famed organizer of the United Farm Workers, was inclined to think so. In the 1970s, he launched his so-called illegals campaign, encouraging union members to report undocumented workers to the authorities and to run unauthorized border patrols. In the 1960s, as it happened, the U.S. once eliminated a program for guest workers called braceros, Spanish for those who work with their arms. At the behest of American politicians worried about domestic wages, including John F. Kennedy. Yet Clemens and his fellow researchers found that wages for native agricultural workers didn't appear to rise in states where the suspended braceros had been most important. The farms there seemed, instead, to have accelerated their use of labor-saving machinery. Repeat the experiment today, many viñedos warn, and the whole industry would go kaput. The most significant academic dissenter from this pro-immigration consensus is George Borjas, an economist at Harvard's Kennedy School. Borjas spies examples everywhere of immigrant workers bringing down native ones, from the ivory tower to the factory floor. One of his best-known papers suggests that native-born mathematicians in the U.S. became less productive, as measured by their pace of generating high-impact theorems and papers, after the Soviet Union collapsed and talented Russian mathematicians flooded their departments. Borjas has long been locked in an econometric duel with David Card, a Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of California, Berkeley, over the consequences of an episode known as the Mariel boat lift. In 1980, Fidel Castro announced that all Cubans wishing to immigrate to America would be free to do so from the port of Mariel, as long as they could arrange their own transportation. In the course of 6 months, an extraordinary number of Marielitos, some 125,000 refugees, arrived in Florida. The incident provided economists with a tantalizing chance to study what an acute surge of foreign workers could do to labor markets. In 1990, Card wrote a paper concluding that, quote, the Mariel influx appears to have had virtually no effect on the wages or unemployment rates of less skilled workers, even among Cubans who had immigrated earlier, end quote.
despite the fact that the influx had expanded the number of available workers in the local labor market by 7%. This was a sensational result. In 2015, though, Borjas circulated his reappraisal of CARD's findings. He argued that the right way to measure the job displacement was to look squarely at non-Hispanic male high school dropouts in the Miami area who would have competed most directly with the Marielitos. Their wages, he calculated, dropped dramatically by 10 and 30%. Supporters of CARD retorted that Borjas had restricted his sample so severely that he was confusing statistical noise for meaningful signal. On it went. Today, Borjas remains a maverick within the profession. Yet even Borjas, who was born in Havana and arrived in the United States at the age of 12, does not claim that the net effect of immigration is negative. Rather, his view is that immigration can redistribute gains, quote, from those who compete with immigrants to those who use immigrants, end quote, in ways that can be socially disruptive. You could agree with him about the distributional concerns while also thinking that a fair government could ensure that everyone was truly better off, that the winners effectively compensated the losers. But what's theoretically possible has to be tested against what's politically possible. Economists can be too impatient with such realities. If the limits of immigration are bounded by political psychology rather than by economic necessity, a series of uncomfortable questions arise. What moral weight, for instance, should be accorded the human desire for cultural continuity? Taken to an extreme, it could legitimize the sort of ethnic separation that white nationalists aspire to when they recite their credo known as the 14 words. Quote, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, end quote. A few months ago, on a drive through Silicon Valley, Ro Khanna, the congressman who represents the only majority Asian district in the continental United States, put the balance to me this way. People don't mind that folks are playing cricket in Fremont. They just want to make sure we have baseball, not cricket, as a national pastime. On the other hand, there's the question of whether rich countries have good Samaritan responsibilities to helping poorer ones. Perhaps especially former colonies. Is there an obligation to bequeath the perquisites of citizenship upon not just asylum seekers and refugees, but also economic migrants who come without any prior authorization? Are unregulated borders consistent with sovereignty? If migration is a fire starter for reactionary populism, which may burn hot enough to endanger democracy, is restriction defensible on the ground of self-preservation? Do we still have an ethical obligation to support open borders? Modern political philosophers have largely found extreme limitations on people's ability to migrate to be unjustifiable. Joseph Cairns, perhaps the most prominent contemporary ethicist of immigration, is a full-throated advocate for open borders. He writes, "In many ways, citizenship in Western democracies is the modern equivalent of feudal class privilege, an inherited status that greatly enhances one's life's chances. If humans all have equal moral worth, how can it be fair to let the dumb luck of birth determine opportunities to such an extreme degree?" In A Theory of Justice, Rawls argued that the rules ordering a just society are the ones we would agree to behind a veil of ignorance about our position in it. If the entire world could be placed behind one such veil, would it settle for the present-day system of tightly regulated borders? It seems unlikely. But Rawls dodged the issue by limiting his analysis to closed societies, in which migration was assumed away. In the book Anarchy, State, and Utopia, Nozick sketched a vision for a minimalist state that prized property rights, but he did not consider the tricky business of people entering and exiting. Yet, here too, the logic may lead to openness. The minimally viable state in Nozick's utopia would be so emaciated, having ceded almost all its power to individual property owners, that it is unclear who could stop someone who sought to wed or employ an outsider. Cairns takes these conundrums as evidence for his position. Whatever account of political justice you adopt, it will confirm the moral necessity of open borders.
In Immigration and Democracy, published by Oxford, Sarah Song, a professor of law and political science at Berkeley, offers an alternative to this depressing dialectic. She writes, "It is not an exaggeration to say that the open borders position has emerged as the dominant normative position among her fellow political theorists. She offers calm and methodical critiques of the logic of open borders advocates, whether they proceed from left, liberal, or libertarian foundations. If such a thing as global equality of opportunity can be conceived, open borders might not even be the best route to achieve it," she contends, "because that approach, quote, would reinforce rather than ameliorate the economic vulnerability of people in poor countries," end quote. She disputes the idea of a fundamental human right to immigrate, which would require the dismantling of the world's borders. When Song returns to constructing her own account of the state and its right to regulate movement into and out of a territory, she arrives at a middle road. Quote, "What is required is not closed borders or open borders, but controlled borders and open doors. Citizenship creates a special set of commitments that can be in tension with our humanitarian universalist commitments. You cannot believe that people have the right to collective self-determination, a core principle of international law, without also ceding them the right to regulate a polity's membership." You might wonder, as I sometimes did as a student taking classes on political theory, how much these thought exercises actually matter. Countries will continue to restrict immigration despite the opinions of professors. But political philosophy can take a long, circuitous route to practice. The great English philosopher John Locke published his two treatises on government in 1689. A century later, it inspired Thomas Jefferson as he helped draft America's divorce letter to Britain. Karl Marx published Das Kapital half a century before Vladimir Lenin founded the Soviet Union. And so the intellectual contest held today may affect how future generations traverse whatever of the globe is left to them. In the U.S., opinion poll after opinion poll shows that immigrants are deeply optimistic about the course of their adopted country. Demographic transitions have often been marred by oppression and violence. If America proceeds peacefully, it would help secure economic primacy over closed and sclerotic societies like China's. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and will be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.